Well, good morning again. We're going to continue our Road of Life series today, and one of the things that happens in the Road of Life is sometimes things that you thought were way in the rearview mirror, happened a long, long time ago, have a way of coming back up, and you have to deal with the consequences of a decision or an activity that you did years and years previous. We'll see that happen today in the life of Joseph, who we've been following, and we certainly have plenty of modern examples today. You'll see an athlete every once in a while come out and find out that they've been using performance-enhancing drugs, and so something that they had done in their past is now affecting their present and their future and the way they're treated, the way they're looked at. You see it happen in the lives of leaders, especially politicians, whether it was emails that you wrote a long time ago or microphones that were recording and you didn't know it a long time ago. The past has a way of catching up with us and suddenly becoming relevant to our current day. We certainly see that happen in Joseph's life, and we've been following him throughout the last chapters of Genesis. We first met him when he was 17, but last week we saw this young man get out of prison and that he didn't actually even belong in, and he became the prime minister of Egypt, second in command of the entire nation. And we saw that's quite the rags-to-riches story, but it's even more amazing when you realize he's not even Egyptian. He's from a completely other land. He grew up in Canaan, and his brothers had sold him into slavery when he was just 17 years old because he was daddy's favorite, and he really got on their nerves, and they wanted to kill him, but they decided instead to sell him into slavery, all because of a couple of dreams that he had had that he shared with them about one day ruling over them. And so no doubt Joseph has had an up and down, twisting, turning life. Lots of bumps in the road, but now he's in a great position. He's using his gifts and he's leading people and he's helping people. And we saw part of what got him into that position was he correctly predicted before Pharaoh what Pharaoh's dreams meant, that Egypt was going to have seven really good years of crop production, and then they were going to have 7 years of famine that would affect the entire region. So Pharaoh put Joseph, not only is he second in command in all the nations, but he's also going to be administering this food program. We left off last week in Genesis chapter 41. Let me just read the last two verses of that to remind us where we were. So with severe famine everywhere, Joseph opened up the storehouses and he began to distribute grain to the Egyptians. For the famine was severe throughout the land of Egypt, and people from all around came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe throughout the world. So let's get the timeline straight here. 7 years of good crops in Egypt have passed. Joseph has done what he can to store up everything in the silos and the storehouses. He's got it all stored up. So that's gone. So Joseph, when we found out last week, was 30 years old when he was called into Pharaoh's service. So now he's in his late 30s. It's now been 20 years since he was sold into slavery back in his homeland of Canaan. And so today what we're going to talk about is not necessarily Joseph's past catching up with him, but it's more his brother's past. Because as we talked about, the famine was great everywhere, including his homeland of Canaan. So here in the midst of Joseph's story, after following Joseph for all these weeks, we get kind of a subtitle, Meanwhile in Canaan, and it switches back to Joseph's family. Look at that with me in chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob, who if you remember was Joseph's father, had 12 sons in total. Joseph was his favorite, but is now gone. When Jacob heard that grain was available in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why are you standing around looking at one another? I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy enough grain to keep us alive. Otherwise, we'll die." So Joseph's 10 older brothers went down to Egypt to buy grain, but Jacob wouldn't let Joseph's younger brother, Benjamin, go with them for fear that some harm might come to him. So Jacob's sons arrived in Egypt along with others to buy food, for the famine was in Canaan as well. And so we just get a quick glimpse. While we've been following Joseph, we get this quick glimpse back of what family life was like here. Jacob apparently has a new favorite. It was the other son from his favorite wife, Rachel. Now keep in mind, as we're talking about favorite, these are grown men. I mean, even Benjamin, the youngest now, who's the new favorite, was probably in his mid-30s, was around 35 at this point, and probably even had sons of his own. Apparently, everybody else was sent to Egypt because they were expendable to Jacob, whereas Jacob still retained Benjamin as his new favorite. And so today we're going to look at the entire story of these brothers making their journey to Egypt. And so I'm going to do my best to quickly cover three chapters of the story, and then we're going to look at what we can learn from our own lives about when our past catches up with us, when we've done some stuff that we wanted to remain hidden, but now it's out in the open. What do we do with that when that happens on the road of life? So let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll get going with the story. God, thank you so much for bringing us here today to worship you, to lift you up, to fellowship with each other, to love on one another, to learn from your word. Mainly, God, we're coming here so that we leave here different people. We want to leave here changed. This is a difficult subject for many of us, God, because some memories are going to come up, some things that we've buried down very, very deep. It can cause hurt in life. It can cause confusion. It can cause frustration. All kinds of emotions can come up, as we'll see in this story today. But as they come up in our own hearts and in our own minds, I pray that we'd be able to give them to you and recognize you as a God who is in control. And so, God, we hand this all over to you today. In Jesus' name, amen. So the brothers head down to Egypt to buy some grain. So join me in chapter 42, verse 6, and let's read through this story. Since Joseph was governor of all of Egypt and in charge of selling grain to all the people, it was to him that his brothers came. When they arrived, they bowed before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph recognized his brothers instantly, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where are you from?" he demanded. "From the land of Canaan," they replied. "We have come to buy food." And although Joseph recognized his brothers, they didn't recognize him. And he remembered the dreams that he'd had about them many years before. And he said to them, "No, you are spies. You have come to see how vulnerable our land has become." "No, my lord," they exclaimed. "Your servants have simply come to buy food. We are all brothers, members of the same family. We are honest men, sir. We are not spies." "Yes, you are," Joseph insisted. "You have come to see how vulnerable our land has become." Let's pause right there for a second. It can be shocking that they didn't recognize Joseph, but that's not that far-fetched. Have you ever not recognized somebody after 20 years? It has happened to me quite a bit in the last year after being gone for 20 years and moving back into this community. It just happened at my daughter's soccer game yesterday. I introduced myself to somebody and he said his name and we were both embarrassed. He looked different. He had glasses on and a hat on. I didn't recognize him. The same is true of Joseph's brothers here. It's not that surprising that they don't recognize Joseph. Think through all the things he had been through. I mean, number one, they thought he was dead. They thought he was done. Once they had sold him into slavery, he's gone. He's out of the picture. He's 20 years older. He's changed a lot since he was 17. He has an Egyptian name. He's been clean shaven to look like the Egyptians. He's wearing Egyptian clothing to match his position in the government. And we find out later he's speaking to them in Egyptian through an interpreter. So there's really no reason for the brothers to expect this to be Joseph. But here he stands before them. Can you imagine the emotions that Joseph must have felt as his brothers come walking into his court to ask for food? Just all that emotion just come crashing together. You feel a little bit of relief to see that they're still alive. And then he starts to feel anger about what they did. And then he feels a little bit of joy. And then he feels a little bit of bitterness. I mean, all these things going back and forth because he had pretty much put this whole situation behind him. Remember last week we saw he named his firstborn Manasseh, which in part meant, "Thank you, God, for helping me forget my family." I mean, he had put it behind him, and yet here they were now. And remember Joseph's dreams and how they must have come flooding back to his mind at this moment? He had a dream of these wheat stalks bowing down to his wheat stalk, and he had a dream of the moon and the stars bowing down to him. All these dreams came flooding back, and not only was there some satisfaction of, see, I knew this was going to happen, there must have also been some surprises. I never thought it would happen like this. But here is my brothers coming back to me to bow to me, and I'm going to rule over them. The brothers call themselves honest. I think that's funny, don't you? Joseph probably, yeah, right, in his mind. Honest maybe about hurting me, but not telling anybody else about it. He must be suspicious of them and their character. So he must have had some lingering hurt or doubt about them. So he decides to speak to them harshly and not reveal his identity. He decides to go ahead and make them think that he is a stranger. So the brothers try to explain that they're not spies. Verse 13, "Sir," they said, "there are actually 12 of us. We are your servants, are all brothers, sons of a man living in the land of Canaan. Our youngest brother is back there with our father right now, and one of our brothers, well, he's no longer with us." But Joseph insisted, "As I said, you are spies, and this is how I will test your story. I swear by the life of Pharaoh that you will never leave Egypt unless your youngest brother comes down here. One of you must go and get your brother. I'll keep the rest of you here in prison. Then we'll find out whether or not your story is true. By the life of Pharaoh, if it turns out that you don't have a younger brother, then I'll know you are spies." So Joseph put them all in prison for 3 days. And on the third day, Joseph said to them, "I'm a God-fearing man. If you do as I say, you will live. If you really are honest men, choose one of your brothers to remain in prison. The rest of you may go home with grain for your starving families. But you must bring your youngest brother back to me. This will prove that you are telling the truth, and then you will not die." To this, they agreed. So obviously here, Joseph doesn't actually believe they're spies. He knew exactly who they were. He was doing all of this to break down their defenses and find out if he could trust them. I mean, you've noticed in stressful situations, you learn a lot about somebody else, right? So Joseph is creating a stressful situation for his brothers so that they'll reveal who they really are and whether or not they can be trusted anymore. And so he devises this test of their truthfulness. They think it's to determine whether or not they are spies, but he's really using it to see whether or not they've changed. And I think he's kind of excited to see his younger brother Benjamin again. And so he tells them that, "I've changed my mind. I'll only keep one of you." And I believe that's because Joseph was genuinely worried about the starving people. Those were his family. And so he sends 9 of them back with plenty of grain and supplies for those people. But he keeps one of them. Pick up the story again in verse 21. "Speaking among themselves, they said, 'Clearly we are being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw his anguish when he pleaded for his life, but we wouldn't listen. That's why we're in this trouble.' 'Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy?' Reuben asked. 'But you wouldn't listen, and now we have to answer for his blood.'" Not always that helpful to tell somebody "I told you so," huh? But Reuben does anyway. "Of course, they didn't know that Joseph understood them, for he had been speaking to them through an interpreter. But now he turned away from them and began to weep. When he regained his composure, he spoke to them again. Then he chose Simeon from among them and had him tied up right before their eyes." Let's pause there again. The brothers here assume that God or fate is conspiring against them, and this is some sort of weird karmic payback. And that is what we would call that. A lot of times when our past starts catching up to us, we believe in this thing that's not a biblical concept called karma. It's actually a Hindu concept, but for some strange reason, we believe that if we do good things, unrelated good things will happen to us. But if we do bad things, then unrelated bad things will happen to us. And I just want to reinforce that that is not a biblical concept. What they are suffering here, even though they don't realize it, is the very consequences of what they did years before. They think it's just some sort of God or fate or the universe paying them back, but that's not a biblical concept. We see all the time good things happen to bad people, don't we? And we see bad things happen to good people. It doesn't work like that. That's not how life works. Instead, what they're suffering here is not fate or the universe paying them back. It's the logical consequences of what they did. That's important when we get to the application later. We also see something else here that's so important. For Joseph, this was very significant. Even though they don't realize that they just admitted their guilt, Joseph heard them take ownership of what they had done to Joseph. They even went to the degree to say, "We even heard him pleading for his life and we completely ignored him." They owned the entire situation. They said, "It's our fault." And so that can go such a long way in mending a broken relationship. For Joseph to hear them take responsibility for their actions is huge, is huge. And so Joseph kept Simeon and sent the rest of them home, but he decides to continue the test and play a little bit of a trick by including their money bags, the things that they had paid for this grain with. He had them included in their sacks of grain. We're not sure why he did this. Perhaps this was a part of the test, or maybe he was just genuinely caring, unaware of the stress it was about to cause them. It was probably a little bit of both. He knew it would cause them stress, but he really wanted to care for the people back there as well. And when they arrived home, they told their father Jacob that this strange man in Egypt wanted to see his youngest son Benjamin as proof that they weren't spies, and he was going to hold Simeon until Benjamin showed up. But then they found the money in their food sacks and they started freaking out. Let's fast forward to verse 35. As they emptied out their sacks, there in each man's sack was the bag of money that he had paid for the grain. The brothers and their father were terrified when they saw the bags of money. Jacob exclaimed, "You are robbing me of my children. Joseph is gone, Simeon is gone, and now you want to take Benjamin too? Everything is going against me." Then Reuben speaks up again, says to his father, "You may kill two of my sons if I don't bring Benjamin back to you. I'll be responsible for him, and I promise to bring him back." But Jacob replied, "My son will not go down to Egypt with you. His brother Joseph is dead, and he's all I have left. If anything should happen to him on your journey, you would send this grieving white-haired man to his grave." And so after seeing this money in the bags, basically the implication there was that they hadn't paid for this grain. Therefore, they had stolen all of this grain from Egypt, and there was no way they were going to get Simeon back. Jacob just said, "It's done. I've lost two sons. Joseph is dead, Simeon is dead, and now you guys want to take Benjamin back down there? There's no way I'm going to allow this." Reuben tries to convince his father by offering his two sons as some sort of weird trade, as if that would help. "If I don't bring back Benjamin, you can kill two of your grandchildren." That doesn't really make sense to me, but Jacob says, no, that's ridiculous. "I refuse to send Benjamin. He's all I have left." That would make you feel good as one of the older brothers, huh? "But Dad, there's 10 of us." And so Jacob continues to refuse, but then things got worse and they got to the point they didn't have a choice. Look in chapter 43. "But the famine continued to ravage the land of Canaan. When the grain that they had bought from Egypt was almost gone, Jacob said to his sons, 'Go back and buy us a little more food.' But Judah said, 'The man was serious when he warned us. You won't see my face again unless your brother is with you. If you send Benjamin with us, we will go down and buy more food. But if you don't let Benjamin go, we won't go either. Remember, the man said, 'You won't see my face again unless your brother is with you.'" So apparently the famine had gotten much worse in Canaan, or maybe it lasted longer than they expected. Jacob acts here as if running down to Egypt is like Walmart or something. Just go down and buy us a little more food. And we don't know how long it had taken here. It'd probably been about a year, and the famine was still going on. And so maybe Jacob actually forgot their previous conversation, or maybe he just hopes that they forgot, because he did not want to release Benjamin. And so however long it had been, remember, Simeon is still sitting somewhere in an Egyptian prison, one of Jacob's sons. He's written him off to protect his favorite Benjamin. This time Judah tries to convince him and begun to speak up before, and now he continues in verse 8 of chapter 43. Judah said to his father, "Send the boy with me, and we will be on our way. Otherwise, we will all die of starvation. Not only we, but you and our little ones. I personally guarantee his safety. You may hold me responsible if I don't bring him back to you. Then let me bear the blame forever. If we hadn't wasted all this time, we could have gone and returned twice by now." So their father Jacob finally said to them, "Well, if it can't be avoided, then at least do this. Pack your bags with the best products of this land. Take them down to the man as gifts. Balm, honey, gum, aromatic resin, pistachio nuts, almonds." These must have been the things they were capable of growing, because remember, they're in a famine here. "Also, take double the money that was put back in your sacks, as it was probably someone's mistake. Then take your brother and go to the man. May God Almighty give you mercy as you go before the man, so that he will release Simeon and let Benjamin return. But if I must lose my children, so be it." So apparently Judah convinces Jacob finally here by saying, "Dad, we don't have a choice. I mean, if you don't let Benjamin go down there, we're all dead, including Benjamin. So we have to do this. You have to let us do this." And Jacob comes to grips with his fate. And I think this is so important for us to see here, is that Jacob has no other option. He's accepting his fate from God. He's saying, "I am not in control of this situation." That is huge for Jacob. Someone who grew up, I mean, his name means the deceiver. He always tried to control the situations, always tried to make it better for him. He's finding out now, "I'm not in control." In verse 14, he says, "May God Almighty give you mercy." The Hebrew behind that is a phrase you've probably heard before, El Shaddai. It's God that's all powerful. May the sovereign God, he's recognizing, "I am out of control of this situation." And so he appeals to the all-powerful God for mercy. The brothers journey back down to Egypt with some of these gifts to help their cause, and they arrive at Joseph's, where he ends up planning a feast for them. They're a little worried when the guards begin taking them to Joseph's house, and they're convinced that they're in trouble over the money that was in their sacks. So they decided to be a little more proactive about the situation. Look at verse 19. The brothers approached the manager of Joseph's house and spoke with him at the entrance to the palace. "Sir," they said, "we came to Egypt once before to buy food, but as we were returning home, we stopped for the night and we opened our sacks. Then we discovered that each man's money, the exact amount paid, was in the top of his sack. Here it is. We have brought it back with us. We also have additional money to buy more food. We have no idea who put our money in our sacks." They're scared to death here. They're not sure what's going to happen, but they're presenting themselves honestly. Verse 23, "Relax, don't be afraid," the household manager told them. "Your God, the God of your father, must have put the treasure back into your sacks. I know I received your payment." Then he released Simeon and he brought him out to them. The manager then led the men into Joseph's palace. He gave them water to wash their feet and provided food for their donkeys. They were told that they would be eating there, so they prepared their gifts for Joseph's arrival at noon. The brothers took an upfront and honest approach here, didn't they? It's almost like you go through the line at Kroger and you get too much change. It says a lot about your character and whether or not you take it back. That's the same sort of thing going on here. The fact that they brought this money back and tried to present it back said a lot about who they were now. They explained the situation, and it turns out the situation wasn't that big of a deal. In fact, that tells us something more about when our past starts catching up with us, we start making all of these assumptions, and we feel like if we come clean on our past, or we bring these sins out into the light, that our world is going to come crashing down, and often that's just not the case. It's just not, we exaggerate it in our minds. We're afraid. One of the things that drives us about our past is fear. We're afraid that people will know who we really were or what we really did. And those, turns out, are often just assumptions. At this point, with the way they're being treated, the brothers must have felt at ease, but they were still in Egypt. They're still not home. They're still in this strange man's house, and they can't completely relax until they are on their way home, back to their father. So now they need to go eat with this man. Verse 26, when Joseph came home They gave him the gifts that they had brought him. Then they bowed low to the ground before him. After greeting them, he asked, "How's your father, the old man that you spoke about? Is he still alive?" "Yes," they replied, "our father, your servant, is alive and well." And they bowed low again. Then Joseph looked at his brother Benjamin, the son of his own mother. "This is your youngest brother, the one that you told me about?" Joseph asked. "May God be gracious to you, my son." Then Joseph hurried from the room because he was overcome with emotion for his brother. He went into his private room where he broke down and he wept. After washing his face, he came back out, keeping himself under control. Then he ordered, "Bring out the food." The waiter served Joseph at his own table, and his brothers were served at a separate table. The Egyptians who ate with Joseph sat at their own table because Egyptians despise Hebrews and refused to eat with them. Joseph told each of his brothers where to sit, and to their amazement, he seated them according to age, from oldest to youngest. And Joseph filled their plates with food from his own table, giving Benjamin five times as much as he gave the others. So they feasted and they drank freely with him. This is an interesting scene, not something we expected to see back in chapter 37 when Joseph is being sold into slavery. And the whole thing had to be strange to everybody involved except Joseph. Joseph was probably having fun with this, but everybody else thought it was just weird. All of Joseph's assistants and the other Egyptians can't figure out why this guy is treating these foreigners with such respect. Can't figure out, why are you even having these guys over for a meal? We hate Hebrews. Meanwhile, the brothers can't really understand why they're there either. And they're trying to figure out how he sat them in the exact right order. Last night, because I'm a nerd, did the math on this of how it would be, what would the odds be of sitting these brothers in order, 10 of them, because he knew where Benjamin would sit. But the other 10, the odds of doing that randomly, assuming I did my math right, was about 1 in 3.6 million. I mean, it was just so far-fetched. That's why they were so amazed. How did this strange man just do this? And so the whole banquet had to be a little strange to just about everybody. They still don't realize who they are eating with or why. And so now the party's over. They had a great time, but now it's time for them to head home. Everything finally seems to be in the clear for the brothers. They didn't get in trouble for the money. Simeon is back with them. They have plenty more grain to take home. And most importantly, Benjamin is okay. So Joseph decides to test them some more. They deserve it, right? I mean, honestly. Chapter 44, when his brothers were ready to leave, Joseph gave these instructions to his palace manager. "Fill each of their sacks with as much grain as they can carry, and put each man's money back into his sack." Does this again. "Then put my personal silver cup at the top of the youngest brother's sack, along with the money for his grain." So the manager did as Joseph instructed him. The brothers were up at dawn and were sent on their journey with their loaded donkeys. But when they had gone only a short distance and were barely out of the city, Joseph said to the palace manager, "Now, chase after them and stop them. When you catch up with them, ask them, 'Why have you repaid my kindness with such evil? Why have you stolen my master's silver cup, which he uses to predict the future? What a wicked thing you have done.'" So the guards did as Joseph asked, and they went and they raced and they caught up with his brothers and they stopped them. And the brothers were certain this time, "We have done nothing wrong. None of us could possibly be this stupid. We didn't take anything. We don't have this silver cup you're talking about. In fact, feel free to search our bags." And they even agreed that if the silver cup was found, whoever's bag it was found in would be a slave for the rest of their lives in Egypt. So in verse 11, they all quickly took their sacks from the backs of their donkeys and they opened them. The palace manager searched the brothers' sacks from the oldest all the way down to the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. When the brothers saw this, they tore their clothing in despair. Then they loaded their donkeys again and returned to the city. Joseph was still in his palace when Judah, one of the brothers, and the rest of the brothers arrived, and they fell to the ground before him. "What have you done?" Joseph demanded. "Don't you know that a man like me can predict the future?" It's easy when you're actually the one doing it, right? Verse 16, Judah answered, "Oh, my Lord, what can we say to you? How can we explain this? How can we prove our innocence? God is punishing us for our sins. My Lord, we have all returned to be your slaves, all of us, not just our brother who had your cup in his sack." "No," Joseph said, "I would never do such a thing. Only the man who stole the cup will be my slave. The rest of you may go back to your father in peace." Well, that was the problem. Without Benjamin, they couldn't go back to their father in peace. They were in a very difficult situation here. And I find it interesting that now Judah seems to be the spokesman of the group. It's not the oldest Reuben, it's Judah who is coming to the forefront. If you remember all the way back when all this happened, whose idea was it to sell Joseph into slavery? It was Judah's. If you remember, Judah said, "Why should we just kill him and not get anything? Let's at least sell him and make a buck." And so he suggests this to the group. So commonly, Judah has been a spokesman for the group, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. He begs this man to reconsider and explains the need to return him to his father. And let's skip down to verse 30. This is Judah continuing to talk to try to get this man to give Benjamin back to them. "And now, my Lord, I cannot go back to my father without the boy. Our father's life is bound up in the boy's life. If he sees that the boy is not with us, our father will die. We, your servants, will indeed be responsible for sending that grieving, white-haired man to his grave. My Lord, I guaranteed to my father that I would not take care of, or that I would take care of the boy. I told him, if I don't bring him back to you, I will bear the blame forever. So please, my Lord, let me stay here as a slave instead of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. For how can I return to my father if the boy is not with me? I couldn't bear to see the anguish that this would cause my father." We'll pick up the story there next week in chapter 45 when Joseph decides to finally reveal his true identity. He's seen enough, he's heard enough, and he'll begin to reveal his identity to them. But what can we learn from this story? It's an amazing story. This story is just phenomenal. There's ups, downs, twists, and turns. And so now we see that the brothers, what they had done in the past, is now in front of them. They're having to deal with the consequences of this. What can we learn, especially in regards to dealing with things that we've done in the past? Things that we think are buried, that are done, that we don't even talk about anymore. We just don't want them to even be there. We just ignore them. So we've learned so much from Joseph over the last few weeks. Let's learn a few things from the brothers here. And so what we see is that when our past catches up with us, or hopefully even before would be better, but when things start to catch up with us, here's a few things that we can learn from the brothers. Number one, we see them admit fault. We see them own up to what they did. They never tried to hide it. They didn't make excuses. They came to see their sin for what it was. It was sin. I did it. I'm not going to make excuses. I mean, think of all the excuses that they could have made. They could have said, well, Joseph was a twerp. He was annoying. You don't understand. He was a brat. We had to get rid of him. They didn't say anything like that. They didn't blame it on Joseph. They didn't blame it on Jacob. Well, it's our father's fault. You don't understand my upbringing. My dad was always playing favorites. They didn't say any of that. They didn't make any excuses. What did they say? They said, we did this. We did something wrong. We looked into the eyes of that 17-year-old boy who was pleading for his life, and we just shrugged it off, and we did whatever we felt was best for us. When it comes time to face up to our past, when our past is caught up with us, the first thing that we got to do is own it. Just own it. Say, yes, I did it. I did it. I know I wasn't supposed to, and I have no excuses. I did wrong. What I want you to see, too, is it's not karma coming back to get you. It's just your fault. It's the natural circumstances. When you carry something like that for so long, you become a different person. It's the natural consequences of completely living a lie in your life. As you become somebody different. And so the first step to getting rid of this is to just admit the fault. The second thing that we see them do, which I think is interesting, especially for us, because it's so difficult to do, is even in the midst of this, they submitted to authority. They respected authority. When you admit fault, you recognize that you are submitting to the person that you have injured. You don't even realize it, but they were submitting themselves to the person they injured. Did they know they were doing it? No. But they respected his authority over them. And so in our own past, whether it's the government or the police or a pastor or an older friend or family member, we must, when we're coming clean, we must submit to that authority, because all of it represents whose authority? God's. And ultimately, that's who we're submitting to. That's whose authority we're respecting. We saw Jacob finally come to that conclusion that, you know what? I'm not in control of this situation. God, you are God, and I am not. And let's be honest, most of this situation was probably Jacob's fault. A lot of the way he treated his children, he had built a household that stuff like this was able to happen. He finally got to the point where he says, God, you are God, and I am not. That is so important for us in dealing with our past, because who knows what it means for our future. The third thing we saw the brothers do that we need to do when our past catches up with us is to demonstrate change. To allow other people to see that we have changed. That's what this whole test was about, right? Are these just the same brothers that wanted to kill me and instead sold me into slavery? How can I trust them? I mean, we kind of laugh, and maybe some of us think what Joseph did was kind of mean. I think it was pure wisdom. What he was doing was testing his brothers, pushing their character to find out if they had changed or not. And personally, I think the brothers passed with flying colors. I mean, if you look at what they did throughout this, they were honest, they were forthright, they were loving. I mean, Reuben said some stupid stuff, but you can't really hold that against him. He's just trying to figure out the situation. Everybody else in this is honorable and upfront and honest. I mean, the brothers here could have gone free, right? They could have left Benjamin behind. These are the same 10 who really didn't care about Joseph. And so they could have just said, oh, well, dad loses another. Well, another favorite. Maybe I'll be his favorite this time. So we just go on home and leave Benjamin there. But they couldn't do that. And so we especially see this from Judah. Judah, a man who went from selling his own brother into slavery, not caring about his brother's life, to now, what do you see in his life? He's willing to put up his own in exchange for another, which is a foreshadowing of the substitutionary atonement that'll come through Christ, through Judah's line. Isn't that beautiful? It says, take me instead. Take my life instead. You see an incredible change of character here from who they were 20 years ago. Do you guys believe people can change? I believe God can change anybody. I don't believe God can, or people can change on their own. I believe God has to be the one to do it, to change hearts. We don't change on our own out of willpower, but when God gets a hold of a life, we have to believe that people can change, or else the rest of this is just kind of hogwash. Because we are in need of change. My wife and I were talking earlier this week, and how frustrating it can be working with people who are trying to change, and they take, you know, sometimes it feels like 40 steps forward and 41 steps back, and it's just this back and forth. And I told her, I feel like I finally reached a balance, and that you have to believe people can change, or else you'll go insane, that this is all worthless. If we don't actually believe people can change, it's worthless. But if we believe they'll change overnight, then we're going to drive ourselves insane too. Both lead to insanity. So the truth is, yes, people can change, but it takes time. In this case, who knows what God has been doing in Judah's life back in Canaan over the last 20 years, but he has clearly changed. Which leads to the last point. Something that they did was to build trust. You saw them with every demonstration of change, what that did was build trust, to the point where we'll see next week, Joseph can finally reveal his true identity. He's gotten to the point where he can trust them again. They've continued to make decisions. But when you're on the offending end, it can seem to take forever to build back somebody's trust. Yeah, that's true. And you earned it. And you've got to build that trust back. It takes time. Be patient. We often talk about it like a trust account, as if instead of it exchanging money and storing it at a bank, you're storing up trust with individuals in your life. And there's certain times in life that all of a sudden all that trust goes away and you're completely overdrawn. And being overdrawn comes with all kinds of penalties, doesn't it? And it seems like forever until you have to pay that back. But when your past catches up with you and hidden things come to light, be patient and stay after God. Don't run away from the situation. It doesn't make things any easier. Be patient, build trust. And so what I want you to see, just in summary of all four of these put together, the best way to deal with a situation from your past is to bring it into the light. As scary as that is, as intimidating as that could be, the best thing to do with a situation from your past is to just bring it into the light. Because here's the thing, it's going to come into the light at some point anyway, right? Look at Ephesians 5, 13 and 14. Paul writes to the church in Ephesus this, "But their evil intentions will be exposed when the light shines on them, for the light makes everything visible." I like to think that's what the brothers have done here. They did Joseph wrong. They did. They mistreated him. They did something that no sibling should ever do to a loved one. And yet they owned it. They admitted their fault and they demonstrated that their character had changed, because I believe God had changed who they were. So as we respond today, if this is something that you have done, if this is something that's heavy on your heart, if there's something in your past that needs to come out into the light, bring it out into the light. I mean, by saying that, I don't mean that come up here to the pulpit and tell everybody, air your dirty laundry. No, that's not what I mean. I mean, go to a trusted friend who you're in genuine community with, or one of us pastors, or somebody that you trust, and bring this out into the light and say, "Look, I've been carrying this my whole life, it feels like, and it's just so heavy. I want to bring it out into the light." But I also know there's people in here whose hearts are heavy because they're not the offender, they're the offended. And that can make it heavy as well. What do you do in that situation? Well, you kind of leave it in the hands of God, right? Pretty much what Joseph did. And as God brings you the opportunity for reconciliation, you pray to God about whether or not it should happen. We've talked several times in here about forgiveness in the Bible is automatic. You must forgive. But reconciliation always isn't. It depends on the situation. That's what we see here. I think Joseph had forgiven his brothers long, long ago. And now the question on the table was, do I reconcile with them and let them know who I actually am? Or do I just go on about my life? It's kind of up to God. And so I know there's people in here who have offended. I know there's people in here who have been offended. And let's be honest, we're all kind of a mix of both, aren't we? We're all kind of this hodgepodge of both of those. And so may we see God as God today and turn these situations over to him and recognize that light is not our enemy. The darkness is. Let's stand and continue to respond. If you need to come up here and pray or talk to one of us, please do. Or sit in your chair and pray. Or fill out a card so that we can be praying for you this week. Whatever it is, respond.